The following message is from Pastor Steve Lee of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
You know, on our Mexico trip, as I think you've seen through the presentation and the testimonies, I think we were stretched in many ways. Not only the demands of ministry, but also the living conditions, and just struggling through conversations in a language that most of us barely knew. And throughout that time in Mexico, I challenged the team to hold on to this perspective that God is worthy of all of the sacrifices that we were being asked to make. And so if that trip had a single motto, I think it would have to be, He is worthy. He is worthy. And as I reflected on what to preach alongside this mission presentation today, I realized that the next passage in our John series that I'm right now preaching through in the adult services is Mary's anointing of Jesus. And that is a story that beautifully embodies this heart of worship that I think propels missions. And so rather than looking for some outside text, I thought, let me just continue in our John series and preach this next passage. And so I'm going to read the first 7 verses of John chapter 12 and then just make a few quick points about it. Starts in verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As a keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you. You will not always have me. So this dinner in Bethany occurs 6 days before the Passover, during what would prove to be Jesus' final week of his earthly ministry. At the end of that week, he would be put to death on a Roman cross. And Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead, and that miracle was so threatening to the religious leaders that after it, they became determined to arrest him and put him to death. And it therefore proved to be one of his final public miracles that he would do during his earthly ministry. Because in the months that followed, Jesus basically withdrew from the spotlight and avoided these religious authorities who were trying to kill him. And so there's the raising of Lazarus, and then you get a few months, and now we're getting to the final week of Jesus, and right before that week, there's this dinner party. And so the dinner guests must have felt the tension in the air, sensing that everything was going to change in a really short time. And it is in that setting that Mary performs this extravagant act of worship. And the costliness of what she did cannot be overstated. Pure nard was imported from the mountains of northern India. And a pint, which is what she used to anoint Jesus, was, as John tells us, a year's salary for the average worker. So if we try to put it in today's dollars, we're talking about something in the neighborhood of about $60,000 worth of perfume. That jar of perfume would have been considered extraordinarily costly, even for a wealthy family. But Mary doesn't hesitate. Mark's gospel tells us that she actually breaks the alabaster jar that contains the perfume, and she pours the entire contents on Jesus. Both Matthew and Mark tell us that Mary poured it on his head. John tells us she poured it on his feet. And if you look at Mark's gospel, it says, Jesus himself says, she anointed my body. So the implication is that she took this pint of nard and she literally poured it all over Jesus' body. And on top of that, Mary wipes that perfume with her hair off his feet. And that's also striking because in those days, women did not let their hair down in public, never in front of men. It was culturally inappropriate for them to do so. But Mary is willing to endure the embarrassment to show the depth of her love for Jesus. And throughout the Bible, we see the message that true worship must cost us something. When David wanted to purchase land from this man named Araunah to build an altar to the Lord, Araunah offered to give it to him freely. After all, he's the king. But David refused. And in 2 Samuel 24:24, it says, "But the king replied to Araunah, 'No, I insist on paying for you for it. I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing.'" I want to ask you this. Why does God desire costly worship? I believe it is because the cost of the sacrifice is a reflection of his worth. If you look at this time in the Old Testament when the Israelites, who were required to give the best of their flock, were bringing their sick, their diseased, their lame animals to God as their sacrifices and grumbling through the entire process about why God asked so much of them, look at how God responds to that. In Malachi chapter 1, verse 10 to the first part of 11, "Oh, that one of you would shut the temple doors so that you would not light useless fires on my altar. I am not pleased with you, says the Lord Almighty, and I will accept no offering from your hand. My name will be great among the nations." God calls their sacrifices useless because the very purpose of that offering was to display his greatness to the nations. In other words, there is a witness component to their worship. By offering their best, they were declaring the greatness of God. But if their worship was with a complaining spirit, and they gave from their garbage, literally, how does God receive glory from that? Therefore, God says, their sacrifices were worthless, useless. Whether or not we realize it, we are calculating the costs and benefits of every choice we make in our lives. And I think the constant question we are asking of everything we do is it worth it? Is this worth it for me to do? But I think we're asking the wrong question. Instead, we should be asking, is he worthy? Is he worthy? In other words, when we start with God's worth, rather than the cost of the sacrifice, everything changes, doesn't it? Mary understood this. She did not calculate the cost of the nard and ask, is Jesus worth this much to me? Instead, she started by looking at Jesus and asking, is he worthy of my very best? And I think the answer was obvious to Mary. No price was too high. No sacrifice was too extravagant for the one who literally had raised her brother back from the dead and who had given her hope and purpose in life. And I think this is what true worship looks like. Not the careful calculation of what we're willing to give up for God, but the joyful offering of everything that we have. When Mary broke that alabaster jar, John tells us the whole house was filled with the fragrance of that perfume. And I don't think that detail is incidental. The aroma of Mary's worship filled the entire space, touching everyone present. I think the truth is they must have gone home smelling like that perfume. That smell would have lingered in their clothing for weeks. And I think true worship has that impact. When we offer ourselves completely to Christ, as Mary did, that devotion becomes a powerful witness to others. It touches others and makes them hungry for what we've found. Imagine being at a jewelry store, and there's this guy that is buying, you notice, this ridiculously large engagement ring. I mean, it's the biggest one in the store. It's the biggest one you have ever seen. And you're looking at the ring, and you're thinking, that thing has got to cost a fortune, man. And I want to say this. If you observe something like that, you might think briefly about the cost of the ring or the guy who's buying it. But let's be honest here. I think the real curiosity for all of us is, who is the woman that he's going to give this ring to? Who is the woman worthy of a ring like that? Isn't that what we'd all be thinking? I want to see this potential fiancé. I think what's happening here is that the world will know the greatness of our God by the passion with which he is worshipped by his people. When we offer God our best, our time, our resources, our lives, we are making a statement that he is worthy of every sacrifice that we can offer him. What's interesting to me in this story, though, is that Mary's extravagant act provokes an immediate response from Judas Iscariot, the disciple who will eventually betray him. In verse 5, it says, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He calculates the monetary value of the perfume and complains that what Mary did was foolish. It was wasteful. And on the surface of it, his objection actually seems reasonable, even noble, let's be honest. After all, that perfume could have helped so many poor people. John explains that the true motive, though, was not so noble. He says that it was actually rooted in greed, that he was the keeper of the money, he was the treasurer of the group, and that his hope was really that Mary could have sold it, given it to Jesus, and he could have helped himself to some of it later on. But let me say this, even apart from that motive of stealing, I think the truth is many of us can relate to Judas' reaction, feeling that Mary had gone a bit overboard, that in this act of devotion, it was wasteful. And so the second point that I want to make is this. Worship seems too costly, even wasteful, when we don't see the worthiness of our God to receive it. I want to tell you this story that some years back, I heard about this family that had won this really large legal settlement. It was in the millions of dollars. And what I was told was that this Christian family took that entire settlement and they gave it to their church and then to other ministries. 100% of it. They didn't keep a penny of it for themselves. And I wish I could say that I was so moved by that. But the truth is, I cringed a little. Because I thought, okay, that's great. But the whole amount? Really? Like, wouldn't it have been wise to keep some of the money? You could have paid off the mortgage on your home. And you could have set aside some for your kids for college. And then given the rest to the church or whatever you wanted to do with it. Because the truth is, that family was not that wealthy. I just thought of all the things that the family could have done with that money. But I think it is precisely sacrifices like this that have the power to shake our world and make us think about who it is that deserves sacrifices like that. I think when Mary broke that jar and poured out a year's wages of perfume on Jesus, everyone in that room had to wrestle with that question. What kind of person is worthy of that level of devotion? When we don't see God's worth, we focus so much on the cost of the sacrifice, don't we? Why is he asking so much of me? The sacrifice, frankly, doesn't seem worth it. So I want to ask you, how do we move from this kind of grudging obligation to do what God is asking of us to a joyful worship and surrender? I think the answer is not just trying harder to be heroic, to live more radically. I think the answer is simply this. If our sacrifice is to reflect the worth of God, then we must behold his glory over and over again. In Exodus 33, we see Moses in a moment of exhaustion and discouragement. The Israelites have once again turned their backs on God, and yet again, he must intercede on their behalf. And you can sense the battle fatigue in Moses' voice as he pleads for his people once again that God's presence would not leave them because of their sin. What's interesting is that at the end of this plea to God, Moses makes this remarkable request. Let's read verse 15 to 18. Then Moses said to him, "If your presence does not go with us, do not send us from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me from your people, from all the other people on the face of the earth?" And the Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing you have asked, because I am pleased with you and I know you by name." Then Moses said, "Now show me your glory." I think the truth is Moses must have longed for those days when he was on Mount Sinai and he met God face to face and he was bathed in the glory of God in those meetings with him. And I think Moses not just wanted to see God's glory, he was basically telling God, "I need to see your glory." Because it is only in seeing God's glory that Moses believed he could find strength to go on in this incredibly difficult journey that God was asking him to do. And I think the truth is this is what we must experience over and over again as well, being bathed in the glory of God and filled with a renewed sense of the greatness of the God that we worship. John Piper writes, "The really wonderful moments of joy in this world are not the moments of self-satisfaction, but self-forgetfulness. Standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon and contemplating your own greatness is pathological." I think what Piper is saying is if the first time you see the Grand Canyon, your reaction is, "I am great," something is wrong with you. Why do we go to places like the Grand Canyon? Spend thousands of dollars to bring your family there. Why do we do this stuff? It's because I think we all realize that when you are in the presence of that kind of majesty and you realize how small you are, there is something deeply moving about that experience, isn't there? The natural response in those settings is one of awe and wonder, being overwhelmed by the sense of your smallness in the face of that majesty. And the truth is we enjoy that experience. We long for it. We seek it. And that's exactly what should happen when we encounter God's glory. I think throughout our journey of faith, we must encounter God's glory again and again to be reminded of how great His worth is. We need to be overwhelmed anew by who He is and what He has done for us. And this is the last thing I want to say, and I'll start wrapping up here. We not only hunger to behold God's glory, but long to participate in it as well. I can still remember the goosebumps that I would get when I would go to the United Center during the days when Michael Jordan was playing for the Bulls. And every single home game, it was the same. Once that music starts playing and the announcer says, "And now, right, from North Carolina, at guard, 6'6", Michael Jordan," and the entire house goes insanely crazy. Every just regular season game, it was like this. And you realize you are in the house of Jordan. And as we cheered and screamed and clapped our hands, we were not only celebrating Michael Jordan's glory, we were participating in it. That's why we wear jerseys to the game, right, of our favorite players. I mean, if you really think about it, it's silly that we come to the games in uniform. You're not playing in the game. Why are you dressed like them? But it's because we want to participate in that glory. It's also why when players are headed to the locker room, you see this scene of fans reaching out in the hopes of just touching one of these players. Why? Because we are all desperate to touch glory. We want to be a part of the greatness that we witness, to participate in it. C.S. Lewis expressed this beautifully when he said, "We do not want merely to see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it." This is what Mary, I believe, experienced in that moment when she broke that jar of expensive perfume and anointed Jesus with it. She was participating in His glory, joining herself to His worth, and becoming part of the Jesus story. In his letter to the Romans, Paul would write, Now, if we are children, then we are heirs, heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. If indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Paul is saying, if we are willing to identify with Jesus in his suffering in this life, we will participate in his glory in the life to come. You know, I began my message sharing about the challenge that I gave to the Mexico team to view everything that we were experiencing, all the suffering, all the struggle, through the lens of, is he worthy? And the trip was tough in many ways, but I was so moved by how everyone responded. I can honestly not recall a single complaint of anyone on that team. Instead of merely enduring those difficulties, I think the truth is they radiated a genuine joy as they were enduring them. And throughout the trip, I remember feeling many times, I kept wishing, I wish your parents could see you now, you know, could see their children and how proud you would have been of your kids in that moment if you saw how they were behaving. But then I realized what truly matters is that the God who they serve sees it all and receives glory from every sacrifice that is given with a joyful heart.